this session, there are several assumptions about relationships that I would like to question. In fact, the ideas I want to question are more than just assumptions. They're actually fundamental principles of how people understand human relationships at this moment in history. They're more or less the official version of how we've learned to think about each other. The first assumption is the concept of a bad relationship. We hear that term all the time. People will say, "I'm in a really bad relationship." There are call-in shows on the radio where someone is always saying, "I'm in a really bad relationship. What should I do?" But with very few clear and obvious exceptions, I would like to state right now that there are no bad relationships. There are certainly important differences in relationships, and some are certainly better than others in specific areas. Some are definitely more pleasant than others, but there are almost no purely bad ones. The exceptions would be relationships that are clearly abusive or destructive or dangerous, but when that's the case, it's generally quite obvious. And it's possible even these relationships can have a positive side, a potential for growth, if you learn from them and understand how they came into your life. When people usually refer to a bad relationship, what do they mean? Usually a bad relationship means there's a lot of arguing, or one person feels that some fundamental need is not being met. If it's a marriage, one person may feel the other isn't doing enough financially, or isn't helping enough with the children. Smaller disagreements can also become magnified to the point where people start feeling they're in a bad relationship. People will say, "I'm in a bad relationship because my husband won't take out the garbage, or my wife keeps losing her keys, and it makes me furiously angry, so it's a bad relationship." I realize that the first principle, that there are no bad relationships, may sound quite radical. In order to understand it, we really have to look at the second principle as well. The second principle is that no relationship ever completely ends. Let me emphasize that. No relationship ever completely ends. Can you see how that bears on the first point? When people say they're in a bad relationship, I believe they usually have a very specific response they'd like to hear. They want to be told they should get out of the relationship and move on to another, one that will be better. But the next one won't be better unless you understand and learn from the one you're in. And if you understand and learn from this one, it will almost certainly improve. It will get better, and then you won't be in a bad relationship anymore. This leads into the third principle. The third principle is that relationships are constantly transforming, and they're really meant to transform us as well. Every relationship is meant to move us to a higher level of consciousness, a higher level of awareness. If you don't learn from the relationship, meaning you don't go to the next level of awareness, then you will have to repeat the relationship. You may be with another person, but you will be in essentially the same relationship. I really want to emphasize the importance of relationships in terms of synchrodestiny and spiritual evolution in general. Vedanta teaches that there is nothing other than relationships. There is no such thing as a thing. There is only relationships. In becoming conscious of itself, the field creates a distinction between the observer, the process of observation, and what is being observed. As an expression of that three-part division, I experience you and you experience me. We see each other, we hear each other, we can touch each other, but once we've done that, we're no longer the same people. Once we've entered into any kind of relationship at all, we're different people. Because with every new experience, we become something new. We transform. Every observer, by observing that which he or she has observed, becomes someone new as a result of that relationship. So we're really the sum of our relationships, and that sum is constantly growing, or it should be constantly growing. It's so important to understand this, that you are a set of relationships, period. There is no isolated entity. There is only relationship. And the only difference between you and me is a bit of karmic software which has come about because of little identifications with what we have experienced. I'm different from you because I watched a movie that you didn't watch, or you read a book that I didn't read. So we metabolize all of these karmic experiences and we create our individual selves. The individual seems real, but at the deepest core of our being is the true reality. And that true reality is that you and I are the same being in different disguises. Right now, just think for a second about how you create your individual identity. What are the building blocks of your individual self? I can say that I have a medical degree and that I live in California. So on one level, it looks like I'm something separate from someone who has a law degree and lives in Texas. But the only way I can be who I am is because of other people. My individual self is really just one point in a web of relationships. For example, I'm a father, but I obviously wouldn't be a father if I didn't have a relationship. Everything that we do really reflects those relationships. Even material objects create relationships. If I'm a car owner, I'm in a relationship with that car, and the car is an expression of relationships among mechanics and salespeople and painters and many others. From a karmic point of view, the only reason we incarnate, the only reason we take this form as human beings, is to have relationships and to learn from them. And we keep doing it until we get to the point where we experience ultimate freedom. And what is our ultimate freedom? To be able to say to ourselves, I'm the field of infinite possibilities, and in that field I can manifest all my desires. So those are three rather philosophical principles about relationships. Number one, there are no bad ones, unless of course we are talking of pathology, as in abuse. Number two, they never end. And number three, they are constantly in transformation, just like the universe itself. And the purpose of every relationship is to move you or transform you from this level to a higher level of awareness. That's philosophy. Now let's get to practical things. And the practicalities of relationships are also built on certain principles. The most important of these principles can be stated in one short sentence. You must recognize that every relationship is a mirror. When we encounter a person we are attracted to, we see ourselves reflected in that person. And when we feel repelled by someone, when we feel instant hostility to someone, it's also because we see our own image reflected in them. More specifically, we are all attracted to those people in whom we find qualities that we want to increase in ourselves. If I'm attracted to you, it may take the form of physical attraction, or it may be an emotional attraction, or I may admire your intellect, but you reflect to me certain qualities that I want to nurture in myself. And if I'm repelled by you for any reason, then you reflect qualities that I'm denying in myself. In a relationship that's really evolutionary, this mirroring is something very different from envy or ego need. Sometimes people will create a relationship in order to borrow or even steal the traits of others. For example, a powerful man who feels unattractive may try to bolster his ego by making sure he's seen with a beautiful woman. He needs that attractiveness and he wants to take it from someone else. But if the relationship is based on ego need, which is itself built on fear, it's really just a kind of addiction, because I need you. On the other hand, suppose you look at someone and you say, these are the admirable qualities I see in this person. This person is full of life. This person is joyful. This person has courage. And whatever else you admire about that person. And then you also say, I'm not going to just use what that person has, I'm going to become what that person is. When you do that, your relationship is no longer based on need. It's based on transformation. And it's also based on a wonderful kind of playfulness. Because ultimately, the goal of playfulness is to take us to ecstasy, which Vedanta calls bliss. So here is the way to act on the principle that every relationship is a mirror. Identify what attracts you in a person and make a commitment that this is what you are going to become. Nurture those qualities within yourself and for yourself. Now your relationship is coming from transformation and playfulness instead of need. Similarly, if you're distressed by something in another person, make a commitment to identify those qualities in yourself. See them in yourself. It can be hard sometimes. But if you really look at the mirror of that relationship, you will see them. So now, even that supposedly negative relationship has been used to take you to a new level of awareness. And once that's happened, the relationship itself usually starts to transform very quickly. because you're not the same person anymore. You're using the relationship to move to the next level. And when you move to the next level, that's when you'll start experiencing more synchronicity in your life. Right now, we can do an exercise that should really clarify some of these points. You'll need a pen and a few minutes in which you're not likely to be disturbed. I'll pause for a moment to let you get anything you need, and then we'll start the exercise. To begin, think of a person in your life who you find rather annoying. It shouldn't be someone who arouses tremendous anger for you, but just someone who gets under your skin to some extent. When you've identified that person, write down their initials at the top of your paper. Now think for a moment about why you find this person rather hard to get along with. It's best to be as specific as possible. So try to identify 3 to 5 qualities about the person that cause you to react negatively. What is it about them that you find irritating? Come up with at least 3 traits, and 5 of them if possible. Again, I'll pause so you can think about this for a moment. Now, I'm going to ask you to identify another person in your life that you respect, that you find charming, that you find personally attractive. Write that person's initials on your other piece of paper. Actually, some people find themselves thinking of the same person for both positive and negative qualities, but usually it's a separate person. And again, try to identify 3 to 5 traits that you find admirable or attractive about whomever you choose. Now comes the really challenging part of this exercise. Look at those 2 sheets of paper with their descriptions of 2 very different personalities. As you do this, I want you to try to see why what's on those pages has nothing to do with either of those people. I want you to see that these are qualities of your own being and your own nature. As you look at each of the traits that you've designated as distasteful, see if you can identify those same traits somewhere in your own personality. For example, suppose you've decided that you don't like this person because they're so controlling. Can you see in your own life where you have been controlling? Or if not, can you see where you wanted to be more controlling but projected this desire onto someone else? Go through each one of the negative qualities. Think about them carefully. Maybe you can think of specific situations in which you remember acting in this way. Or once again, maybe you didn't act upon the impulse, but even though you suppressed it, you felt drawn to acting that way. See if you can find something for each characteristic that you can own about yourself. Now, this is very important. If you have trouble recognizing one of these traits in yourself, put a check mark beside it and we'll discuss this later. Then look at those positive qualities of the other person you selected. Again, see where you express those traits in your own life. If you like this person because they're very creative, see where you express that creativity. Or once again, it may be that you have the impulse to be more creative, but you hesitate for some reason. instead of taking the risk that goes along with expressing your creativity, you may let this other person do it for you. So when you say you admire something in them, you're really saying that they're doing something you'd like to do yourself. And as you did before, if there's a positive quality that you really can't find in your own life, if you really feel you could never be that way, then put a check mark by that. Now take a moment to think about what we've done. If you've been able to identify these various traits in your own personality, you've taken a big step toward understanding how the mirror of relationships really works. I suggest that you use this exercise whenever you encounter anyone who provokes a very strong reaction in you. It doesn't matter whether the reaction is positive or negative. The real lesson is that you think you're looking at another person, but you're really looking at a mirror image of your own self. Until you take this lesson to heart, you're always going to have a very defensive reaction whenever a difficult person comes into your life. You're always going to think, how can I get rid of this person as fast as possible? How can I get them away from me? But once you understand the extent to which others are actually a projection of yourself, then you realize that an annoying person actually presents a great deal of opportunity for evolution. Because you can say to yourself, that kind of person irritates me. So what is it about myself that the person is mirroring back? What are they showing me that I haven't been willing to look at? And then by coming into contact with that neglected area of yourself, you can really achieve a new level of understanding. And you may even see what a synchronicity it was for that irritating person to come into your life. So from this point of view, your friends who are always nice to you and never challenge you are not necessarily your most valuable acquaintances. Your best friends can also be those people that really annoy you because they're showing you parts of yourself that you haven't focused on. But there's one more thing we haven't covered in this exercise. What if you had one or more traits that you really couldn't find in yourself? Those are the ones you indicated by a check mark. Let me tell you a story that will illustrate how I think those qualities should be understood. A number of years ago, I had a medical colleague who was really quite a brilliant person. He was very careful about his work and he really prided himself on having things very intelligently organized at all times. Once he and I and some friends were doing this mirroring exercise together, and with respect to one of the people who annoyed him, he wrote that the person was an idiot. That was the word he used. He didn't write that the person was silly or even stupid. The person was an idiot. And when it came time to own that trait in himself, he simply couldn't do it. He said, I can admit to those other qualities, but I absolutely know that I'm not an idiot. Under no circumstances am I an idiot, or can I ever remember being an idiot. And he just refused to accept this. And then later that same day, we were driving back to this man's house, which was Boston. It was a wintry day, and we got to his home, and we got out of the car, and he couldn't find the keys to his house. We were standing there outside his door, and he was looking through his pockets, and he was very angry. He said something like, I can't believe it. What kind of a person loses his keys on a cold winter day like this? And of course, it was a beautiful synchronicity. I could feel myself speaking for the whole universe when I looked at him with a smile on my face and said, nobody but an idiot. So if you really think a certain trait is totally absent from your character, I suggest you think again, especially a negative trait. And you'll find the more you embrace that quality, it will be much less offensive when you encounter it. Because when you understand the holographic universe, when you understand that the whole is contained in every part, then you'll see that there really can't be anything that's totally outside yourself. And you'll be much less likely to judge others. You'll be much less likely to see others as either above you or below you. Instead, you'll recognize the intimacy of the relationship that encompasses every human being, and that recognition is a true act of synchrodestiny. Simply by virtue of that recognition, you will increase synchronicity in your life. With respect to synchronicity, there's much more we can learn from thinking about relationships and romantic relationships in particular. I hope everyone has had the experience of falling deeply and passionately in love with another person. That's a very exciting experience that's almost a kind of intoxication, when you can't think about anything else but the other person, when it's also intense and concentrated. This is such a very personal and individual experience, because when it happens to someone, other people just can't understand what's going on. And they say, hey, what's so great about this person? He's so ordinary. Or she's nothing to get so excited about. How could you be so deeply in love? Usually, when people are in that very romantic frame of mind, we say they're infatuated. I'm not sure that's really an appropriate word, because it's derived from the word fatuous, which means silly or stupid. I think the quality of being in love might be closer to wisdom than to stupidity. In any case, it's definitely a kind of inspiration. Being in love puts us in touch with something that's normally out of our reach. It makes us feel powerful. It makes life seem exciting. It makes us feel like all kinds of wild and wonderful things are possible. There are 2 points here that are directly related to synchrodestiny. 2 points that can show us how being in love is like a state of enlightenment, and also how we can use the experience of love to nurture enlightenment. And of course, this is exactly what synchronicity also does. Synchronicity is both a symptom of enlightenment and a means to further enlightenment. What really happens when you're infatuated with someone? What is that experience really like? One of the most striking things about it is the sense that you can see something that no one else can see. It's not really like you're having a hallucination, because you may be perceiving the same physical reality as other people, but you're seeing a dimension within that reality that's invisible to the rest of the world. That ability to see something that others can't see is called second attention. It happens during infatuation, but it can happen in many other ways too. And I believe that every experience of second attention fosters synchronicity. When you experience peace in the midst of chaos, that's second attention. When you feel close to someone who's not physically there, that's second attention. When a prayer gets answered, that's second attention. When you trust your inner voice to guide you into making decisions, that's second attention. When somebody with an incurable illness gets better, that's second attention. When you see somebody's aura or a glow around them, that's second attention. When you feel unbounded, free, infinite, that's second attention. When you feel wonder, that's second attention. When you feel that you don't have to be certain all the time, when you base your wisdom on uncertainty, that's second attention. Can you see why this is like the experience of being in love? Vedanta teaches that a person who's in the midst of spiritual transformation is like an infatuated lover. In other words, becoming enlightened is like being in love. Like an infatuated lover, you're not certain what's happening. An infatuated lover is full of wonder. An infatuated lover is exposed and vulnerable, which is also second attention. An infatuated lover is spontaneous. An infatuated lover is transforming. All these emotions also come up during any period of profound spiritual growth. I once spoke with a man who'd had a very intense experience of infatuation. He was a person who had been leading a perfectly stable life, with a good job and lots of free time to do whatever he wanted. He had been divorced for several years, and he had no children. All of a sudden, he met a woman who was visiting from Europe, and he fell completely in love with her. For a period of time, he became very irresponsible about the practicalities of his life. He made up an excuse to take some time off from his job, and he followed the woman all the way back to Europe. It was all really exciting. As often happens, it didn't last very long, and he eventually came back to us. But in looking back on this experience of wild romantic love, my friend had some insights that I think are very illuminating. He realized that what he'd really been in love with was not just the woman herself, but also with the way of life that opened up to him while this was happening. There was a kind of intensity that wasn't ordinarily present in his life. There was a willingness to take chances, to do outlandish things, to spend money without counting the cost, and to generally live outside the boundaries of a conventional existence. The woman was really a trigger for living that way, for living intensely and spontaneously and without giving much thought to the consequences. As long as those things were happening, he continued to experience this infatuation very strongly. So the feeling of love was both a cause and an effect of a whole way of life. It was only when mundane and ordinary reality started to reassert itself that the emotional experience started to diminish. When a routine sets in, the intensity begins to be lost. When a relationship becomes predictable and conventional, the quality of second attention begins to be lost. The magical side of the person that you alone could see simply can't be seen anymore, and you just see the same person that everyone else does. Again, this brings up an analogy to synchronicity. I've said all along that meaningful coincidence is a fundamental principle of the universe. It's literally everywhere, if only we're able to see it. Once we do see the synchronicity in our lives, once we bring second attention to what happens every day, it is like falling in love. Everything seems to turn upside down. Assumptions that we had taken for granted no longer seem so certain, and all sorts of new possibilities begin to appear. The Persian poet Rumi spoke very eloquently about this analogy. Rumi said that the whole purpose of existence is to be a passionate lover. What could he possibly mean by this? I think he meant when you're a passionate lover, you'll see your life with second attention. You'll discover possibilities that other people don't see. You'll take chances. You'll stop worrying about all the little details. Of course, this is exactly what synchrodestiny also means, and relationship is the foundation of it. Relationship is the ground from which it grows. To conclude this session, we're going to do an exercise for which you'll need a small mirror. If you have a mirror at hand, we can begin. The exercise takes about 10 minutes. Recently, I created a recording of my translation of Rumi's poetry together with some very wonderful actors and singers and musicians. The recording is called The Gift of Love. In a moment, you'll hear a selection from The Gift of Love. But first, I'd like you to look into the mirror for a moment and recognize that the image in the mirror is both yourself and the whole of creation. It's both yourself and the people you love and admire. It's both yourself and the people you despise. It's an image that's here at this instant, but it was also present in the 11th century when Rumi wrote the words you're about to hear. The image is you, but it's also all the relationships that make you who you are. Think about that as you look into the mirror for a moment. Then close your eyes.
Settle with me. Let us be neighbors to the stars. You have been hiding so long, aimlessly drifting in the sea of my love. Even so, you have always been connected to me. Concealed, revealed, in the known, in the unmanifest. I am life itself. You have been a prisoner of a little pond. I am the ocean and its turbulent flood. Come merge with me. Leave this world of ignorance. Be with me. I will open the gate to your love.
As the poetry and the music continue, open your heart to the gift of love. Just listen. But whenever the impulse strikes you, open your eyes and look into the mirror again for a moment. Then close your eyes again and listen.
Today I've seen the charm, the beauty, the unfathomable grace of the face that I was looking for. Today I have found you, and those who laughed and scorned me yesterday are sorry that they were not looking as I did. I am bewildered by the magnificence of your beauty and wish to see you with 100 eyes. My heart has burned with passion and has searched forever for this wondrous beauty that I now behold. I am ashamed to call this love human and afraid of God to call it divine. Your fragrant breath, like the morning breeze, has come to the stillness of the garden. You have breathed new life. I have become your sunshine and also your shadow. My soul is screaming in ecstasy. Every fiber of my being is in love with you. Your effulgence has lit a fire in my heart, and you have made radiant for me the earth and sky. My arrow of love has arrived at the target. I am in the house of mercy, and my heart